Remakers Mark Special Episode 17, In Memoriam 2016. Hello everyone and welcome back to Remakers Mark. Here we are in our 17th special episode, one that we look forward to every year in sort of a weird, macabre, sad way. That is our In Memoriam episode for the year 2016. We're going to be happy to remember and celebrate the lives of those who we lost in the past year. Boy howdy, it was a heck of a year. So we're, you know, it's sad, but at the same time, we're excited to celebrate those people. So we're looking forward to that. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing tonight? This is your jam, a little bit.
Yes,
it is, death is your jam.
Death is my jam, and I'm well. Nice. Thank you.
You are appropriately Nordic medley. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you tonight?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you.
Wonderful. And you're heading off to band practice later, I hear, correct?
I'm going to rock and possibly roll.
Very nice. I remember when we used to make out to that hymn. Lee Henderson Shandling, how are you doing tonight?
Excellent. Thank you.
Excellent. Very good. And finally, Mark Josting, how are you?
Got a fresh bag of shrimp-flavored snacks. I'm ready to rock.
Suddenly, I'm happy there's not smell-o-vision with this podcast.
That sounds terrible.
And I like shrimp. My name is Kyle Delahunt. Normally, I would be your host. However, I will not be your host tonight. I'm happy to hand off those reins to Andy Wicks.
So
I'm
just stage.
Give him the hook. So I'm just going to be a participant this go around. So, Andy, I give the reins to you. You're going to do a great job. Now go for it.
Thank you, and welcome to our discussion of death. How did I get the job of hosting this episode? Anyway.
You were the most eager and enthusiastic about the deaths.
Yeah, just behind the scenes, Andy tends to be the first one whenever someone passes away to send out the email saying, what?
This is true. I tend to see those headlines first. I don't know why.
You have very unique RSS feeds. Like you have like a celebrity death match or celebrity lottery or something, because it's amazingly fast.
Yeah, it is. It's a gift. It's my superpower. What can I say? We're going to go through two picks each, similarly to how we've done in years past. We'll do a more in-depth look first at some of our favorite entertainers that have passed on this past year, and we will recap with a shorter, briefer look at some other names that are worthy of mention. Instead of having some of the listener segments talking about some of their favorite celebrities that have passed on, like we have in years past, we're actually going to have a separate entire episode dedicated simply to those listener picks. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing what some of you have to say. We're going to start with Mark. Mark, tell us about who you are going to be celebrating.
Regretfully, yes. Well, not with the celebration. This one still hurts me that we lost David Bowie. And of course, the man was a legendary musician. His career spanned the early 1960s all the way up until the year in which he died. And I think he was 60 years old or 70 years old. I forget which one.
He turned 70 yesterday, a couple days ago, I want to say, when we were recording. So he was 69 when he died, I think.
Yeah, he had an incredible career. And in 50-odd years of recording, he released 25 albums, which is a huge catalog. Nearly all of them were influential, and he just did marvelous things for psychedelic music in the 60s. You know, he did a graceful turn towards dancier stuff in the 80s, but was still a little bit trippy. He was always on the edge of interesting, and I shouldn't say that. He was fully in interesting, but it was always on the edge of the mainstream, just pushing things to the type of weird that he liked. And the man was weird. He was, especially when early in his career, when he was a young, rail-thin, googly-eyed redhead, and a gay man. You know, he was definitely on the outskirts of social norms, and had a very hard time breaking into stardom, because he met a lot of resistance. And yet, because he was a freaking genius, it took him two albums to become a star. Just two.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there was still a lot of resistance to him as a public personality in his young days, but it was his second album where he released Space Oddity.
Wow, that was his second album. That's crazy.
Second album, yep. And of course, he was also a prolific actor. I haven't seen The Man Who Fell to Earth. That was 1976, by the way. But I have seen Labyrinth like 5 times. And that was the gloriously cheesy 1986 collaboration. Do I have that right? George Lucas and Jim Henson?
Yeah, yeah. I think so.
I believe you're right.
Yeah.
Yes, and, that is correct.
And Bowie played kind of the villain. It's pretty clear from that one that while he may not have been the most skilled actor around, he put his heart into it. Yeah, he gave it his all. And interviews with others that worked with him in the films always portray him as a man who tried his hardest. He was just a great individual for influencing Hollywood and music and, you know, our entire damn lives. I should also mention that that he had a lot of fun with Hollywood as well, doing lots of small parts and the famous cameo in Zoolander.
It's my favorite Bowie performance.
And he's great in it. I should mention that some of the highlights of the small parts are he had a role in Twin Peaks, and he came back for... So the original Twin Peaks was... The film was in the 80s. He came back for the sequel, which was just a few years ago. And then he had an awesome role as Nikola Tesla in The Prestige.
Yep.
My favorite.
Yeah. Awesome there, too. So David Bowie, a towering figure in music, and... just an awesome figure in film. What a great person to have influenced our cultures, and what a sad loss.
Yeah, agreed.
I think I would say he was game for just about anything. And I think in music he tended to lead with that. You know, I mean, like he set trends. You know, he was doing kind of androgyny, or that was. You know, he bubbled up a lot of the trends that were happening in, you know, just a few clubs in New York, or whatever. And then because of what he brought forward in the music he was creating, that then became what was the main trend. You know, like he brought that to the forefront of media. And he was just totally game to try a bunch of different things. And I think that shows with the types of roles that he had in movies, too. So everything from Labyrinth to, Oh my God, I just lost the Christopher Nolan one.
Prestige,
thank you. Sorry. I kept thinking of Inception, and I was like, nope, that is not at all right.
That would have been awesome, though.
Right director. I would love to see him in that. Yeah, indeed. But yeah, I just love that he was game for kind of whatever, and he just seemed like a good dude. Like,
yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I love that he took things that were fringe and even deviant and just made them acceptable, even cool, because a lot of people need that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Very much.
He sang with Annie Lennox Under Pressure at the Freddie Mercury tribute concert in 1991.
It's a fantastic performance.
Yeah, it was amazing. Sorry, 1992. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that was great.
Yeah, we'll link to that in the show notes. It really was. Really was incredible.
And then singing A Christmas Carol with Bing Crosby.
Like, yeah,
this
yeah,
dude
totally.
Is just an enigma.
Oh, yeah. I think like Kyle said, you know, he would do anything that interested him. And he had good taste.
Yep. Yeah, he did.
Yep. Yeah. I would definitely recommend, this is not on the film side, but I would definitely recommend, if you haven't done so already, take a listen to his final album, Black Star. It's out on Apple Music and Spotify and stuff. It's extraordinarily good. And it's a good album on its own, but when you know that, you know, he was, you know, kind of making it when he died. He found out, I guess, a few months before the album came out. I don't know if it was when he was tracking or not that he was terminally ill, but he knew he had cancer, but he didn't know to what severity or to what degree, I think. But anyways, it definitely is a, you know, end of life-ish feel. There's some lyrics that, you know, could play well on their own, but when you think about that, they're just haunting and beautiful, which is pretty much Bowie to a T.
Totally. All right. Rest in peace, David Bowie. Andy, let's move on to you.
Okay. I'm going to talk about Mary Frances Reynolds, more known more commonly as Debbie Reynolds. She was born on April 1st, 1932 in El Paso, Texas, and she grew up in a poor working class family. She moved to Burbank with her family as a teenager, where she was discovered by talent scouts after she won the 1948 Miss Burbank Beauty Pageant. And get this, she was courted by both Warner Brothers and MGM talent scouts, and she was signed to Warner Brothers after Warner Brothers' agent won a coin flip. She went, I know, crazy. Isn't that crazy? She went on to star in several films, perhaps most famously in 1952 as Kathy Seldon in Singin' in the Rain, my favorite movie, opposite Gene Kelly and co-starring with Donald O'Connor. She received an Academy Award nomination for Best Actress for her performance in The Unsinkable Molly Brown in 1964. I didn't realize she was the voice of Charlotte in 1973's Charlotte's Web.
Yeah, I didn't know that until I was kind of reading the retrospectives of late.
Yeah. And another interesting tidbit that I discovered in doing some research here in that she had her own weekly television show from which she famously quit in 1970 after discovering that NBC was airing cigarette advertisements during her program, which she vehemently opposed. And she just walked away from the show and potentially millions of dollars in revenue.
Wow.
She also had a recurring role in Will and Grace, for which she received an Emmy Award, and was also a voice actress on Rugrats.
Awesome.
And apart from all that, she also was an accomplished singer, having singles in the top of the charts in the late 50s and early 60s, often from some of her movies. She appeared in several plays, including Irene, which starred her daughter, Carrie Fisher, who was making her Broadway debut. Debbie received a Tony nomination for the performance. Her collection of nominations and awards includes, but is not limited to, one Academy Award nomination, one Academy Award Humanitarian Award, an American Comedy Award, 5 Golden Globe nominations, 1 Tony Award nomination, and a Screen Actors Guild Lifetime Achievement Award. And on top of that impressive resume, Debbie was also involved with the Thalians, which I was unaware of when I first saw it. It sounded like a cult. But
yeah, is that this, like the Stonecutters?
But the Thalians are a charitable organization based in Hollywood, which focuses on causes related to mental illness and mental health. And she was involved with that organization for 56 years and stepped down as their, I'm going to get the title wrong, I should look it up, but she might be their like president emeritus. And if you know anything about Debbie Reynolds and also with Carrie Fisher, with their personal history, and we'll get to Carrie Fisher later, in fact, in the second episode, that mental illness was definitely a part of both of their lives. And it pleases me to know that Debbie Reynolds spent much of her energy working to address that and to treat it. And going off the script a little bit, but Debbie Reynolds, I first knew of her and discovered my enjoyment of her in Singin' in the Rain, which is just, it's the best movie. It's simply the best movie. But she's fantastic in that she was only, I think, 19 when she filmed that. And you can tell she's obviously younger than Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor, but she really holds her own performance-wise with them. Her character is a young kind of upstart, but she definitely doesn't back down from their star power at the time, which was pretty phenomenal. So she is obviously she was the mother of Carrie Fisher, who was Princess Leia, among many other things, and very tragically passed away one day after Carrie Fisher died. Both of them passed away at the end of 2016. And that was a hard double blow, double stomach punch to, the collective fandom of Hollywood at the end of an already pretty rough year. Debbie Reynolds was a fine lady, a fine actress, and a fine entertainer. So here's to you, Debbie.
Well put.
Mary Frances.
The thing I liked about her most was, up until her death, really, she was always like exploring different things that she wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's like she's got, when you went through her resume, like there's so many different things that she did. And it's not like she just stuck to acting or just stuck to voiceover or just stuck to TV
yeah.
or movies. She did it all. And mm-hmm. I don't even know if it was in your research, but I know that she had her own like variety show in Vegas for a while as well.
Well, yeah, she was a headliner in Vegas for years, and she talked about apparently that was the most exhausting work that she would do, but it was also the most rewarding work that she would do.
Yeah.
I mean, she was doing like 2 shows a night, 7 nights a week for, stretches at a time, but it seemed like she really relished that interaction with the audience and the ability to kind of control and change things as she needed to. And
yep, absolutely. Yeah.
She was a born entertainer.
Yeah. There is a documentary that was made, I think, in the last year or so called Bright Lights, which was supposed to come out later on in the year, but with Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds both passing away, is now out on HBO, either Now or Go or whatever your subscription is. So I would definitely recommend it. It's basically just a story about them living next door to each other and kind of living their lives together. So there was a path between their house, like Carrie Fisher would make dinner every night and bring it over and they would have dinner together. And it was very, you know, I think certainly they had dysfunctions individually and together. But it's a pretty unique relationship and pretty special relationship. And it was really something to lose them both so close. I mean, just unbelievable gets overused, but truly unbelievable.
So let's move on to Jer. Jer's going to talk about someone who is very near and dear, I think, to all of our hearts.
Yeah.
Thanks, Andy. I'm going to talk about Gene Wilder, who passed away back in August of this year at the age of 89. He was born back in the 30s, 1933, in Milwaukee, or as the Algonquins say, Miliwake.
Doesn't that mean the good land?
Why, yes, Mark, it does. I love this fact that I found, but he was born to, or rather his parents were salesmen. His dad sold novelty items door to door. And I think that's probably the most Gene Wilder-ish thing that I could think of. He is an accomplished film and theater actor, screenwriter, director, even an author later in his life. He didn't really catch on to the mainstream public eye until the 60s. So already well into a theater career in his 20s, he started getting a couple of roles in some small television shows and movies, and then really took off when a mutual friend introduced him to a man by the name of Mel Brooks. And Mel Brooks was working on The Producers at the time. Actually, it was called Springtime for Hitler back then, but met Gene Wilder and said, "You would be perfect for this." And they ended up becoming friends. He got that role, obviously, got nominated for some awards for it. And that began a collaboration with Mel Brooks that spanned at least three movies that I know of. That one into Blazing Saddles, into Young Frankenstein. And that was his 60s and 70s career of just molding this manic comic energy that was just unparalleled in that time. And then transforming from that into this bizarre pairing with him and Richard Pryor that went through the late 70s and 80s, even into the late 80s, where they did four or five movies together. And he, unlike a lot of comedians that in the 70s and 80s that we all know and love, Gene Wilder was never a stand-up comedian. He was he had roots in vaudeville. He had roots in theater, and he loved to write. And even in his early roles, when he was doing things in the 70s and 80s, even he was always asking to change things, looking for a better way to tell a joke, a better punchline. And so he was this wonderful combination of these old school vaudevillian antics and smart, clever writing, and just this odd energy that could transform into so many different roles and characters. Most famously is going to be Willy Wonka for most people, which when you watch the original Willy Wonka, you cannot picture anybody else doing that but Gene Wilder. And
certainly
when
not.
When Johnny Depp tried, he failed. And Johnny Depp's a pretty good actor that knows how to transform into a character. And Gene Wilder just put him to shame as far as that goes. And
yeah, that's still my favorite on-screen performance.
Of Gene Wilder's or just...
Gene Wilder's.
Okay. I was going to say, ever? He was... I've said this about different people.
I'm sorry. I have to interrupt you again. Yeah, that's my favorite on-screen performance ever. The Gene Wilder performance of Willy Wonka.
Brilliant. That's a bold claim, too. I've said this before. I don't know that we've really talked about it much on the podcast, but there are actors and actresses that I think that when you look at them, you think you were just born in the wrong time. You have the sensibilities of somebody from the golden age of cinema, and you're this 80s actor or actress or whatever it might be. Gene Wilder was born in the perfect time. He spanned through these amazing decades of film and theater and brought things that had the sensibilities and the practices of all of those different mediums and all of those different time periods, and just brought them to the forefront, moved them to the next decade, to the next style, to the next way that we interpret comedy, and just kept on doing that through his entire career. Whether it was acting, screenwriting, directing, he was always using what he knew, but also building on that. And there's not another comedian that is like Gene Wilder. And I don't love everything that he did, but the things that I do are high, high, high on the list of comedies that I have watched in my life. Blazing Saddles being way up there. Young Frankenstein, like Mark said, his performance in Willy Wonka is just unparalleled. There's just so many things that his fingers have touched that have influenced how we laugh. And he's just an amazing figure. He died of complications from Alzheimer's. And that was, it was something that people kind of knew was happening, knew what was coming up. So it wasn't like a really big surprise or anything, but it was something that he was trying to keep relatively to himself and out of the public eye. And then I'll end with one other really interesting fact that in looking at his life, I found he died back in August, like I said, in his home in Connecticut. And according to his family, he died listening to his favorite song, which is Over the Rainbow by Ella Fitzgerald.
Oh, man.
Nice. Starting and ending his life in very Gene Wilder-ish fashion. And just an amazing, amazing heart of a man.
I forgot that he was married to Gilda Radner.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, when he wasn't in movies, he was always off the spotlight. He was never a tabloid figure. Like, he was just a guy that did it because he loved acting and really loved doing it and loved bringing joy to people, whatever that meant, you know, from, again, Blazing Saddles to Willy Wonka to silly comedies. Like, he did it all. I miss him greatly.
And I love that his last acting credit is Yo Gabba Gabba.
Uh-huh. And do you guys know what his first movie was?
Tell me.
It was not the producers. It was Bonnie and Clyde. He's one of the people that get kidnapped. It's like their first kidnapping along the way. He and his like girlfriend or fiance or something like that. He's just like, he's kind of nobody then, but he's perfect in that as well. So I love that. It's one of my favorite movies. So I have fond memories of that.
Gene Wilder is the kind of actor that I would love to bump into at a coffee shop and
yeah,
and just say, hey, you're Gene Wilder. And because he's unassuming. He isn't in it because of the spotlight. The spotlight just happens to be around him. And I just think that he would be one of the more down-to-earth people to just bump into and sit with over a coffee for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
So, Gene Wilder, thank you for everything that you did.
Thank you, Gene Wilder.
Thank you, Gene Wilder.
Let's move on to Kyle.
Yeah, so mine is a gentleman named Alan Rickman. I was very sad to lose him this year. He was born in 1946 in West London. He was actually kind of a latecomer to drama. He started out as a graphic designer. He actually ran his own graphic design firm. But at the age of 26, he did some theater. He decided to go into acting, and he ended up getting a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London. And his first movie, like, he did some TV stuff, you know, nobody just goes straight into a movie, but his first movie was Die Hard. And that is the role that that pretty much people knew him for darn near 30 years or 25 years.
Here.
Yeah, that was his first movie. He did TV movies before that, but he never did any movies. So his first movie was Die Hard. Like, that's insane.
The best Christmas movie of all time.
That's right. And so he played the villain in that film named Hans Gruber. Now, the writing, like Die Hard is a very good movie, and it's an especially good action movie, right? So, I mean, it is sort of unique in that way, in that it's very clever, it's very funny. It takes what action movies should do well and does them all quite well. It's very violent. Like, I love 80s blood squibs, and that one has some of the best. Like, I'm just a huge fan of that. And it's got, you know, witty dialogue. It's got one-liners that aren't annoying. You know, I mean, it's really got a lot going for it. But basically, you know, it was fairly standard action fare, just really good action fare. But his performance, to me, was leaps and bounds above what the writing and the dialogue did for the movie itself. So, I mean, just him on his own playing a German guy, right? Hans Gruber, you know, as a Londoner with Welsh background, like he did a pretty much perfect German accent. You know, I can't imagine. I have a feeling that everyone said like, oh, so you grew up in Germany, and be like, no, I grew up in London. Like, how long did he probably answer that question?
Except they'd be no, I grew up in London.
You do a pretty good Alan Rickman.
I miss Alan Rickman's voice.
Oh man, seriously, so unique. So you know, his character was just cold, calculating, creepy, and complex. The four C's, if you will, and it was really kind of a template for action movie villains over the next, man, pretty much since then. So like, if ever there is an international villain, like, it's Hans Gruber-y in some way, shape, or form. So that's pretty amazing. So he didn't quite get typecast per se, but I think he, just by virtue of his voice, certainly, and his presence and his kind of steely look, he got to be known for villainous roles like Hans Gruber. He was the Sheriff of Nottingham in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, but he was definitely not a one-trick pony. I thought he was pretty unique. He did some other lighter roles. He was in Dogma. He played the role of Metatron, which is God's right-hand man, basically.
Yes, I love that movie.
Yep, he was great in that. He was in Love Actually, and I actually kind of showed his age in that a little bit. He was in the TV show King of the Hill. He played a king in that. Huh. And he was also in one of my favorites, Galaxy Quest, which is sort of a spoof on sci-fi culture. He played kind of a Klingon-esque character, if I'm remembering correctly. Just really funny, and you know, never gave up the ghost in that. Never, you know, gave away that it was anything other than a serious role within that movie, and at the same time within Galaxy Quest. I just thought he was fantastic in that. So underneath even that persona, that steely look, that amazingly unique voice, there was definitely a sense of humor there, and definitely a lot of really interesting aspects there. And then finally, and maybe most famously of all, I don't know, he took on the role of Severus Snape in the Harry Potter film franchise. He started that at the age of 55. Think about that. So he did those movies over, I think, 10 or 11 years. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Snape is probably 40s, maybe low 50s in the movie, and he looks pretty young. And so he was doing like action stuff. He was, you know, really active and really into it starting at the age of 55. From the age of 55 to 65, he played Severus Snape. And to me, much like the Star Wars prequel trilogy, basically kind of in a sneaky way proved to be as much or more a story about Obi-Wan Kenobi as it was about Anakin. So at the face, it was about Anakin, but it really proved to me to be the story of Obi-Wan Kenobi and the struggles that he felt and sort of his development as a Jedi and as an individual. The Harry Potter heptalogy, yes, I looked that up, proved to be as much a story about Snape's sacrifice and redemption, and most of all, kind of the overall theme of the whole franchise is love. So everything that he did for love. And you know, when that reveal happened, I just felt so fulfilled by that and so inspired and so appreciated that. The fact that viewers and readers viewed Snape equally as a hero and a villain throughout the series speaks greatly to his skills in the movies. Not to mention the fact that, again, he hung in there in a physical role in his 60s. He really owned that performance in every way imaginable. I just think he did. I truly can't think of anybody else that could do what he did as Severus Snape. Like, it's one of those just indelible roles that I can't imagine anyone else who could have done that, which is pretty, pretty amazing.
And for Harry Potter fans, there are some edits out there on YouTube that show all of Snape's scenes in chronological order. Ooh. And heartbreaking.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah, I haven't seen those. I also check that out.
Go find those.
Okay. I'll see if we can find those. We can link to those in the show notes. Cool. Thank you for that. I was not aware that existed.
My pleasure.
So I basically can't think of anyone who can fill Alan Rickman's shoes. You know, I mean, he was such a unique individual, but in a way that was accessible and really interesting and fun and scary and intimidating, but I still wanted to have a beer with him. You know, I mean, just one of those. But it also gives me hope that there are like Alan Rickman style actors out there waiting to have their Hans Gruber opportunity, if you will. The one that comes closest to me is Michael Shannon. He strikes me as somebody he's a little creepier, pretty close. But he to me seems like somebody that can do a lot of different things. He's about as close as we have now. But really it just makes me think that there are those individuals out there, those actors, whether they're character actors, lots of different things that, are just waiting to have that moment where they get that perfect role for them and then suddenly they can take off and do the life they want. So here's to whoever is out there and doing that. And thank you, Alan, for leading the way in that. He passed away on January 14th. He was 69 years old, another 69-year-old with Bowie. So that's a rough
And also
rough
had pancreatic cancer, which is, isn't that what David Bowie had? Pancreatic cancer?
I think so. I believe you're right.
I believe so.
Yeah, so it's a big loss. I look forward to revisiting all of his movies many times over throughout the future. I mean, we watch the Harry Potter movies all the time, and I just think so highly of him for doing that and the way that he portrayed that. So, Alan, you'll be missed, and thank you for everything.
Kyle, I also wanted to throw in one that you forgot that is significant to me personally, and that is that he voiced Marvin the robot.
Yes.
Paranoid
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah.
He was perfect for that.
He was, and there is not, I hope someday they remake that movie, or remake that book, movie, whatever, and do it better. But when they do, nobody is going to do the voice of Marvin as good as he did. And he wasn't even the first one to do it because they had the old radio drama that came out on BBC. And then I don't even remember who did that. I might have been Stephen Fry even, but nobody's going to do it as well as Alan Rickman. Nobody's going to be the voice of Marvin as much as he was.
Yeah.
I would give Cumberbatch a pass, but that's only if he does a Rickman impression, really.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much, yeah.
He's basically the only one who can.
Alan Rickman's his ability to play villains so well, and he really did, between Gruber, Sheriff of Nottingham, and Snape, we'll call Snape a villain, I think led his comedic roles to be so funny. So funny. Like Marvin the Paranoid Android and the character, I forget the character's name from Galaxy Quest. Like the contrast was so striking. Made it that much better.
Yeah, very well put. Yeah, agreed. Lee, on to you for the last of our long picks.
Well, I wanted to talk about an actor who I discovered when I was a teenager, but by then he was already probably approaching the end of his career, and that's George Kennedy. The first time I ever remember seeing him in anything was when some friends of mine and I rented the first Naked Gun movie. And not knowing what it was, and then laughing our asses off all the way through it. And he was very much a supporting actor in that, as he was most of his career. But he was one of those guys who, even though he played a lot of supporting roles, I think most people knew who he was, and he was held in very high regard. One of the more memorable things that... for me anyway, that's in his resume is a movie called Cool Hand Luke, which I saw a couple of years later, in English class of all things, 11th grade English class. We were discussing, the subject of conformity and mob mentality and what that meant and, you know, examples of it in literature and media. And the movie that our teacher chose to show us was Cool Hand Luke. And she pointed out a lot of things that happened in the story, you know, and what it means, how, you know, that relates to conformity. This is the first class I understood what conformity was, but he was brilliant in that as a character Dragline, and deservedly so. He won an Oscar for it, in 1967 or 68. I can't remember. And I think that's really his most memorable role. There are probably a lot of other TV and film appearances that I'm not mentioning because I just don't know his entire catalog. But I think he's a terrific actor, and I have a lot of great memories of his performances from when I was a kid.
Yeah, I sadly don't know much of him besides Naked Gun. I have seen Cool Hand Luke, and I kind of forgot that he was in it, believe it or not. But yeah, he was so funny in The Naked Gun. I mean, I really want to watch that movie again. I'm in a mood for just total screwball, airplane, you know, Spaceballs, Naked Gun movies. Maybe that's just 2016 speaking through me, given how, you know, rough of a year it was that I just want to laugh my booty off. But yeah, that I'm definitely in the mood for that. And he added to that a lot.
That's a good prescription, Kyle. I think we could all benefit from that.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, definitely. Some screwball comedies. Hell yeah.
Yeah. It's one thing. One thing I would like to note that has nothing to do with his acting career is he's a World War II veteran. He served in the infantry, and the division he was in was part of George Patton's Third Army, and he won 2 Bronze Stars.
Wow.
Wow.
So thank you, George Kennedy, for your service.
Hear, hear.
Thank you, George Kennedy.
Guy did it all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. When we usually say that a Hollywood personality did it all, we don't refer to earning stars in the military.
That's true. That's true.
He's a first.
There's a lot of them, though.
All right. That wraps up our first round of discussions, our longer picks. Mark, to recap, Mark talked about David Bowie. I spoke of Debbie Reynolds. Jer talked about Gene Wilder. Kyle discussed Alan Rickman. And Lee talked about George Kennedy. Once again, we're going to have a separate episode for all of the listener-submitted segments. We're very excited about that. We're going to go back now to a briefer recap of some other celebrities that we lost that we thought are worth mention and discussion, and we're going to start with Jer.
Yeah, my lightning pick, or whatever we are calling it, is a little different than Gene Wilder. I just wanted to take a brief note on Richard Adams, who is an English author, born back in 1920. He died in December, I believe, of this year, just recently. He is probably not known to most people. He's a pretty prolific author. The main book that anybody would know him by is the novel about rabbits called Watership Down, which is it came out back in the 70s, I believe. But it was a anthropomorphic story about rabbits and their society, and just this really interesting allegory, kind of on the same lines of Animal Farm, but way less governmental in focus.
Yeah.
He started that story because he was telling his daughters a story that he was making up on a car ride one day, and it blossomed from there. When I was a kid and began learning what it is that I liked and what were the things that you know made me desire to read and made me want to be creative and want to know more and seek out the next thing. The three books and series of books that are all on equal footing for me are Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, and Watership Down. I read them all in a fairly short period of time, probably in the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, maybe not fourth grade, fifth, sixth, seventh grade, somewhere in there, 10, 11, 12, 13, over and over again. They all, for me and for my life, they are all equally as important. And I know that most of the world doesn't see it that way. You know, Tolkien and Lord of the Rings is just this giant of fantasy fiction, and C.S. Lewis is obviously important in his own spheres and realms, but not as talked about as Watership Down. And I think it's a wonderful, significant book. And for Mark and Andy and maybe to a lesser degree, Kyle, if you really want to scar your children, show them the old animated movie based on Watership Down. It is
can't wait.
Brutal.
Yeah, it's a hell of a downer. Yeah.
Pass.
Looks like Richard Adams was also a World War II veteran.
Hmm.
In the British Army.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, he's, I mean, if you guys haven't read it, read it. I would encourage everybody to do that. I have a beat up old copy on my bookshelf that I've leafed through many times in my childhood and adult life. And yeah, I don't know much besides that about him. But yeah, he, and because of that book and because of that, him is a significant piece of you know, how I grew up. So thanks for that, Richard.
Yeah, I've seen the movie, but I've not read the book, so I will have to do so.
Yeah, that movie is does not pull punches.
For sure. That's an understatement.
I'll pass the proverbial baton to Kyle to speak on somebody who is very near and dear to all of us here at this podcast, I know.
Indeed. So my shorter pick is that of Kenny Baker. Kenny Baker is best known from the Star Wars films. He was born in Birmingham, England in 1934. While his parents were of quote-unquote average height, Baker grew to a total height of 3'8" as an adult. So because of his stature, he was, you know, into entertainment and was approached to star in theatrical troops and revues featuring dwarves. You know, we were called midgets at the time, but thankfully we're not using that term any longer. Little people who basically, you know, they were unique. And, you know, unfortunately were the features of a lot of shows at that time. But that did get him into show business, which eventually led to him playing the role of R2-D2 in the Star Wars films. So it wasn't just that there was a stationary robot, you know, this hunk of metal that was on set. There was a man in R2-D2, and that man was Kenny Baker. I don't know if a lot of people know that or not, but he brought a lot of life and personality to what could have been a fairly bland hunk of metal. You know, I think if you were to just look at R2, it's interesting, but the reason that you love R2 is because of the little shimmers and the, you know, a lot of the noise as well, or noises that he makes. But because of how he acted in that, you know, think about being stuck in basically a trash can for several days of filming on a movie. And that's what he did. And he brought life and personality to that role, so much so that, you know, if someone were to say, what are some of the main characters of Star Wars? Like, no one would leave out R2-D2 in spite of the fact that there's nothing humanoid about it at all. It's this rolling trash can.
Yeah.
And that's pretty great.
Yeah. See, he played a robot who didn't have any language, but brought such personality. I mean, the bleeps and bloops and screams sometimes are certainly expressive, but R2 never says any words.
I mean, yeah.
Like, C-3PO has a personality because of his language, because of his delivery of lines. R2 yep. doesn't get that luxury and still is a powerful personality.
Yeah. Hear, hear. So he played R2 in both the original trilogy and then also in the prequel trilogy. And then he consulted on both the in-person and computer-generated R2 performance in The Force Awakens. He starred in many other movies. Some of these I was very surprised by, including Flash Gordon, The Elephant Man, Time Bandits, Amadeus, and Labyrinth once again. So we come back to Labyrinth. So, you know, he certainly had a well-regarded career outside of Star Wars, but definitely is most well-known for R2, and we're very thankful for that for him. He passed away on August 13th, 2016, at the age of 81. So we will send our bloops and bleeps to you, Kenny Baker. Thank you for all that you did.
Aww, sad
Kenny Baker.
Nice. Good work. Mark, on to you. This is a big short pick, but a short pick nonetheless.
Yeah, it just speaks to how big our list was for this year.
Yeah, it really was.
Yeah. So, Prince Rogers Nelson, born in 1958 in our very own Twin Cities, was a Hollywood triple threat of the writer, actor, director, and he made all of three movies. He made Purple Rain in 1984, which was interesting. And Under a Cherry Moon in 1986, which is perhaps more interesting but less good. And Graffiti Bridge in 1990, which was just terrible. Of course, Prince was a musician, not the Hollywood triple threat. He was an ambitious person, which is why he made those movies. He was a visionary. And And of course, Purple Rain, the best of his three movies, is was all about him as a musician, even though it was not supposed to be him, but it was him. Yeah, the character's name was The Kid, but yeah, he was a singer, songwriter, guitarist in Minneapolis playing in First Avenue with the time. That couldn't be Prince at all, could it? as a musician, oh my God, he recorded and released, well, I should say, he released almost 40 studio albums. There's probably more out there. He had vaults of recordings. And that's just studio albums. That's not live compilations, other stuff. Best of stuff. I mean, including best of. I can't imagine how many albums he's released. I mean, the catalog is just mind-boggling. And the talent is also mind-boggling. The radio hits that this man generated is off the literal charts.
And yeah.
Yeah, there's so many hits from probably four decades. And to speak of his respect in the music industry, I mean, this is a guy who was known for funk mostly, and a lot of his significance was blending funk with rock, but still, I mean, he was known as a funk guy. But then, in a tribute to George Harrison of Beatles fame, in a giant celebrity mashup covering While My Guitar Gently Weeps, when you have the big figures of Tom Petty and Jeff Lynne and Steve Winwood. And of course, Prince is there. Why would Prince not be with Tom Petty and Steve Winwood? it's just because, like, who else do you get to play in a tribute to one of the best guitarists ever in rock? And they didn't get Eric Clapton. They got Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was just that important to guitar, to music, and to culture. Maybe not so much film, but culture.
I'm sure there's been a gajillion movies that have featured Prince songs in the soundtrack too. I mean, none come to mind immediately, but I'm sure there's dozens of them out there. Yeah, Batman. Hell yeah.
So that's something that should be mentioned. There's a ton of movies with Prince songs in the soundtrack. He was asked to do a song for the Batman soundtrack, and what he delivered was an entire album.
Yeah,
that was awesome too.
Yeah, that soundtrack is a gold record. He was a very weird guy, but he was a very ambitious guy, a visionary. He did what he wanted. He never let anybody tell him what else to do, and he did consistently amazing stuff.
I like that he was an all-around musician. He wasn't just a singer. He wasn't just a guitar player. He wasn't just a songwriter. He did everything. Like, he could play anything. Any of the instruments on his album, he could play it.
And did.
Yeah.
And did.
And he was a performer. Like, he didn't just play music. He performed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, seeing his live performances, I was always struck by how much he didn't rely on his guitar. Like, he employed a lot of really fantastic guitarists to do most of the guitar work, and then he stepped in for the solos and did his lead stuff. He always put the performance first.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting to me, because he also had a reputation of demanding the most from not just his band, but everybody on the road crew. And like, I would think that a guy like that would lean on his own guitar work and be the type to not trust anybody else.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, he I would assume wanted to make sure that he just delivered the best performance.
Yep.
So Prince Rogers Nelson, Twin Cities own, beloved and dearly departed.
Yep. If you're up for reading a lot about the sort of memories of Prince, Andrea Swenson from The Current here in Minneapolis, St. Paul area, kind of built up a really unique, interesting relationship with him over the last few years, and just had wrote a lot of really, really wonderful pieces since he passed away, all worth checking out. Everything from just going to see Paisley Park now that it's a museum, to trying to find where, what was the actress's name from Purple Rain? Boy, my memory is terrible today.
Apollonia Katero?
Apollonia, thank you. Yeah, where she purified herself in the waters of Lake Minnetonka, which was not at all Lake Minnetonka. So she went and checked that out. It's just really, really unique writing. She's a great writer. She's got a really great perspective, and it's really worth checking out. I'll see if I can kind of put all that together.
Cool, cool. Lee, let's move on to you.
Sure. My shorter pick is, believe it or not, another Minneapolis native. Her name is Noelle Neal. And the reason I chose her is because she is the first actress to ever play Lois Lane. She first played Lois Lane in, either a miniseries or a made-for-TV movie in 1948 of Superman. And then she revived the... She was rehired to play Lois Lane on a TV series in the 1950s called The Adventures of Superman. And then when I went to see Superman Returns back in 2006, I think that came out, she's in the opening scene as the dying like heiress that Kevin Spacey's character, Lex Luthor, is trying to bilk out of her money.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Huh. Yeah, I didn't know that's that. Her. Yep.
Huh, cool. That's awesome.
And most recently, I bought a Superman like Blu-ray set, and I was watching the original 1978 Christopher Reeve movie, and she has a very small part in one of the Smallville scenes. She's on a train when Clark is racing the train. I don't know if you've seen the movie. Clark Kent is racing the train, and she's on the train, and her little girl nudges her and, you know, points at this guy who's racing the train.
Cool.
She plays the mom.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah.
Also nice. Great.
Yeah.
But I thought that was kind of fun to see, and I've been a big fan of Superman since I was six. So, of course, I have an appreciation for the first actress to ever play Lois Lane. I think she was fantastic in it. And I'm not going into all of her other work. I'm just not as familiar with it. But from what I understand, she was very accomplished and had a very long career. So she lived a full life, and I believe she was in her 90s when she passed away.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Right on.
Awesome.
Up next, Andy won't have to transition himself here. I'll take care of that for him. Andy is going to talk about someone that we also lost fairly recently.
Georgios Kyriakos Panayiotou. I'm sure I pronounced that without flaw. Was better known as George Michael. He was a singer, most famous for his membership in the 80s group Wham! And an extensive and highly successful solo career. He passed away just at the tail end of 2016, I believe on Christmas morning. He sold more than 100 million records worldwide. In addition to his musical success, he was an advocate for LGBT rights and HIV/AIDS awareness. He officially came out as a homosexual in 1998. Along with Prince, George Michael could be considered a pop icon. Let me rephrase that. Along with Prince and David Bowie, George Michael could be considered a pop icon who blurred gender stereotypes and sexuality. His songs and videos were often provocative, dealing with social issues and his own personal struggles. He was certainly a guy who was not without his run-ins with the law or his run-ins with controversy, but I think throughout his entire career, he was a beloved performer, songwriter, another artist who kind of redefined himself as his career went on. We talked about that with Debbie Reynolds and with David Bowie. They really didn't stick to one thing and ride that till it was a dead horse. You know, he went from 80s pop to kind of covering soulful ballads to singing with Aretha Franklin to duets with Elton John to really maintaining a strong pop presence and career, you know, until his death. So I have memories of my older sister getting his Faith album on vinyl back in when it came out. And I remember my parents being very hesitant about buying it for her. Yeah. Cause you know, had some controversial songs on it, including I Want Your Sex. but really, he had some really phenomenal pop songs. I was just looking at our list of people that we talked about, and if you count Debbie Reynolds, four of them are singers.
Yeah.
Yep.
And really, I mean, if you look at our list of just pure actors, we have Gene Wilder, Alan Rickman, George Kennedy, Kenny Baker, and Noel Neal. And the rest were hybrids of performers, entertainers, writers, singers, anything like that. So I just find that interesting that we, as a movie podcast, aren't really good at talking about only actors on these In Memoriam episodes. But I also think it speaks highly to their quality of their careers as actors, musicians, as creators, really. So
it's artists.
As artists, thank you. So, so George Michael, again, he was 53 when he passed away. He was relatively young. And as far as I am aware, a cause of death has not been determined. He was
inconclusive.
He was just, found in bed on Christmas morning, unresponsive. So here's to you, George Michael.
You're here.
I was never a huge fan of his work, but I appreciated him as an artist and, you can't really argue with someone who, you know, sells 100 million albums.
Yeah, he's doing something right. You
know? Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And
just to reference the Freddie Mercury tribute concert again, he did a solo performance of Somebody to Love, and it was amazing.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Oh, I love that song.
I mean, the guy's got a fantastic voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think he was probably my first awareness of, you know, I was young enough that at his peak, I was still too young to kind of really be into his music. Like I said, my older sisters were. But at the same time, even just looking at his album covers and his media, you know, his presence in pop culture, that he was a sex symbol, but not like he was a sex symbol for, you know, teenage girls. Like he was just like, that is a sexual being right there. My goodness.
Yeah.
And
yep.
It was frightening.
It is. It's weird.
I didn't understand this.
Indeed. And that's okay, Andy. That's okay.
It's just where I was in life at the time.
Yeah. So. Has anybody seen the movie Keanu with Key and Peele?
No.
See, George Michael plays a surprisingly large part.
Oh, really?
In that. There's a scene. So the movie is jacked up in all the best ways. It's pretty darn funny. But at one point, basically to prove themselves to try to get this cat named Keanu back, the characters that Key and Peele play kind of join this gang to go like, basically rough up some people, and Peele goes in with one of the gang members, and then Key stays out in the van, and it's his van. And so like he was talking about how Faith is his jam, and so they were listening to George Michael, and he like basically invents kind of a story about George Michael, and then they're all like, man, that George Michael is the bomb, yo. He just makes stuff up about him. So he had a point in our culture that was non-traditional, let's say, through that movie, but really, really funny.
All right.
I would just add that George Michael wrote Careless Whisper when he was 17 years old.
Man.
Wow.
That sax solo.
Yep. It's stuff that legends are made of.
Fantastic.
Nice.
All right. So that does it for this year's, or for our In Memoriam 2016 episode. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for, remembering and celebrating the lives of a lot of the, entertainers that we lost. The list this year was much, much longer than we could ever possibly hope to get to. Kyle, maybe we can post, the list that we had compiled, which is by no means exhaustive, just to show people what we had to try to sift through. And you know, let us know some of the famous entertainers that you wish we would have talked about. Tell us who we missed. So with that, Remakers Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you will find show notes with links to all of the people, movies, and links discussed in this episode. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, where you can rate and review Remaker's Mark, which would mean the world to us, really would. We are on Facebook, just search for Math is Hardnet, and Twitter, now at Remaker's Mark. So please join in the discussion there too. Gentlemen, thank you for talking about people we've lost. May the Force be with you.
And also with you. Down this stabbing courtroom.